All right, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Let the record show that it is 8:32 a.m. Central Time on October 31st, 2013, and we are present in the Public Service Commission hearing room in the state capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota, for a hearing scheduled in the matter of applications filed on July 26th, 2013 by Northern States Power Company, also known as NSP, for an advanced determination of prudence for a proposed purchase power agreement for the 200-megawatt Courtenay Wind Project to be located in Stutsman County, case number PU-13706. A proposed purchase power agreement for the 200-megawatt Odell Wind Project to be located near Mountain Lake, Minnesota, case number PU-13-707, and a proposed purchase of the 200-megawatt Pleasant Valley Wind Project to be located near NSP's existing Grand Meadow Wind Farm in southeastern Minnesota, case number PU-13-708. And on August 13, 2013, NSP filed an application for an advanced determination of prudence, case number PU-13-742, and a certificate of public convenience and necessity, case number PU-13-743, to purchase the proposed Border Winds project to be located in Rolette County, North Dakota. The commission consolidated the two cases for hearing pursuant to North Dakota Administrative Code Section 6902.0404. The issues to be considered in this hearing were set forth in the September 25th, 2013 Notice of Consolidated Hearing. I will not repeat those issues here. My name is Bonnie M. Fetch. I'm an independent administrative law judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I am the procedural administrative law judge designated to conduct this hearing. And at this time, I'm going to ask counsel to state appearances for the record. Carrie Valley is on record as counsel for Northern States Power. And Ms. Valley, please identify who's present with you and who will be testifying for NSP.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Culk, Commissioners, Judge Fetch, Carrie Valley appearing on behalf of NSP. With me here today is Zev Simser as co-counsel. Witnesses today will be our Regional Vice President, Laura McCartan, and our Director of Resource Planning, Mr. Kurt Hager. Company representatives also here today are Dave Cedarquist and Mark Nisbet.
Welcome. All right, Mitchell Armstrong and Brian Schmidt are on record as Special Assistant Attorneys General representing the Commission. Is Mr. Schmidt present, Mr. Armstrong, or is it just you today?
Just me.
All right.
With me is Jerry Lean, Public Utility Analyst. He will also be advisory staff to the Commission.
Okay, thank you. And Ryan Norell is present to represent the Commission Advocacy Staff. And Mr. Norell, please identify any advocacy staff present who will be testifying.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Commissioners. Sarah Cardwell joins me on behalf of Advocacy Staff, and she will be testifying. And Mr. Mike Diller is also at table with us on behalf of Advocacy Staff as well.
Thank you. All right, there are no interveners or protestants in this proceeding. Members of the Public Service Commission present today are Brian Kalk, the Commission Chair who holds the portfolio in this matter, Randy Christman, and Julie Fedorchik. And at this time, Commissioners, I will ask for your opening comments, beginning with Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you, everyone, for the work you've done so far putting this together. It seems like we just had this with Excel on the rate case, which I guess brings me to the one thing I'd just like to put out there. Maybe, Mitch, you can help clean this up a little bit. But I assume by now everybody has seen the letter that basically I'm asking to consider the information in this case as I make the decision in the rate case, as we make the decision in the natural gas case. So I guess one of the things I'll hope to hear from quickly from the company is if you're going to object to that, And if you are, we'll see where that goes. And if you're not, I'd like to get that on the record as well, too. And the reason I guess I put this letter in there is that we're in the middle of something I've never done before. And I've only been here, 4.5 years, so it's not like it's maybe never been done before. But, we're used to having a rate case here and there and an ADP here and there. And now we're in the middle of a rate case with Xcel Energy that has issues about a wind farm in there that are very, I would say, in my viewpoint, maybe not contentious, but different than maybe what we're used to with some of the fuel cost rider being used in that way. We've had this filing now of 750 megawatts of wind to drop into the grid based on what kind of need, I guess. I've read the testimony, but we'll hear that, and there'll be a lot of questions about it. And then there's, I think, what is it up to now? Several different plants at 250 megawatts of natural gas that were going to be in Hankinson, and I heard directly from staff, but that maybe this wasn't going to happen, and all this stuff going on right now. And I really think these cases are all related, and I think you're really going to have to sell me that why you need all this wind and why you'd need the gas tied to the load growing in North Dakota or somewhere else, and what the share of this might or might not go to North Dakota ratepayers. And I'll even go back to the ADP law. The way I understand the ADP law, it says the commission may, not the commission shall. So I've always been very critical of ADPs in all venues, because I've never been convinced, nor was Chair Tony Clark when he was here, about the benefit of ADP to ratepayers. And so somewhere in the testimony today, I'd like to hear your thoughts about that. But usually we start off on a very fun tone. Let's get going. But I like to put the cards out early, because I think this is we're in the middle of a very intricate set of hearings right now that it's very important we get through them and get a decision, I think, as quickly as possible. But I want to make sure I get all my thoughts out there early to give you a chance to educate me why I am or am not correct. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We will deal with the letter that you sent in just a moment. Commissioner Christman?
I don't really have a lot to add to what Commissioner Kalk said. He took most of the points that I was going to make in opening. So I guess I'm just ready to get rolling and first of all get that clarified, the combining of the information from the various cases. But other than that, I'm ready to get started.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchik?
Just a couple thoughts. I've been running around the state to whoever will listen to me talking about the changing landscape of the electric industry. And I think this case really illustrates a lot of the issues that I address in that speech and have been thinking a lot about just in the last 10 months since being on the commission. This is a really dynamic time in the electric industry, and we're incorporating a lot of new technologies, new national and state policies, and new systems with MISO. And so it's challenging to work through all those questions, concerns, problems. And I think this case is right in the middle of all of that. All those issues are at the heart of this matter. And I think that the company and the staff have done a nice job addressing some of the pros and cons and providing some direction and thoughts. And I really look forward to the next day, or however long this takes, to have you all answer some of my questions and concerns and get a little bit more thorough discovery on these issues. So thank you.
Thank you, commissioners. I'm going to outline the hearing procedure, and then, counsel, we have a couple of matters to discuss, okay? So we will begin with the applicant, NSP, to present their case for granting the applications. Each witness called by NSP will be subject to cross-examination by Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Norell. And following that, members of the Public Service Commission and I may also ask questions. And after that, I'll entertain further questioning as may be necessary. In an evidentiary hearing, the Commission must base its decision on the evidence and information presented at the hearing. Documentary evidence must be introduced and marked as an exhibit and admitted into the record. The commission may not base its decision on information obtained outside of the hearing. Are there any members of the public present this morning? All right. Seeing none, I'll move along. The burden of proof is on the applicant, NSP, to show by the greater weight of the evidence that its applications in the five cases consolidated in this matter should be approved by the North Dakota Public Service Commission. And at this time, counsel, first of all, I received notification yesterday, Mr. Norell, thank you for sending me an email indicating that you had spoken with Mr. Simpson and Mr. Armstrong, and that the council intends to stipulate to admission of the applications and all pre-file testimony in this matter. Is that the case?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Then at this time, then, the applications and the pre-file testimony are all admitted. All right. Let's move along then to the letter notice from Commissioner Kalk of his intent to take official notice of evidence received in other cases. Do you all have a copy of that October 9th, 2013 letter?
I have extra if you need, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Simpson, do you have a copy?
Not with us, no, ma'am.
All right. The chairman has some extra copies. Could you come forward? Anyone else need a copy? Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Norell?
No, Your Honor.
Anyone else care to see it? There are copies here. All right. Would you take a look at that letter? And I'd like to hear from each of counsel you have any concerns or questions or issues with it.
This is Mitch Armstrong, advisory staff. And on behalf of the commission, we would ask that the parties agree that the commission can take official notice of the records in connection with this matter in case numbers all PU-13 and the identifying case numbers being 706, 707, 708, 194, 195, 742, 743, as well as PU-12-813.
All right, Mr. Norell, do you want to chime in?
Just no objection on behalf of advocacy staff.
Mr. Simpson or Ms. Valley?
Thank you. We have no objection.
All right. Chairman Kalk, does that answer your...
That answers my question. Thank you, Your Honor.
The only concern, I guess, I would voice is that in they are all NSP cases, so if they were cases brought by another company, then I would have a concern because then the company would not have had an opportunity to examine the evidence and the witnesses. But since they are all cases brought by the same company, that allays that concern. So Commissioner Kalk and other commissioners, there is no objection to you taking official notice of the records in these other cases. Counsel, is there anything else in the way of any preliminary matters or issues that we need to discuss before we move to production of the evidence? And I see Ms. Valley and Mr. Simpson are nodding their heads. No, I don't see anything else.
Nothing from me, rather.
All right. Just one other thing. Do you have the exhibits, an extra set of the exhibits, Ms. Valley, Mr. Simpson? somebody? Yes. Do you want to pass those out at this time?
Sure. These are the official ones. For the
All right.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this is Ryan Norell with advocacy staff. Would you like advocacy staff's exhibits?
Thank you.
Your Honor, would you like advocacy staff's exhibits as well?
I would, Mr. Norell.
Or exhibit.
Thank you.
And just one note, Your Honor, and for the commission, the packets the commission have received do not have the very lengthy attachments with all the contracts, but we have those available if you want to see them.
All right, thank you. I see only one exhibit sticker on these, Mr. Norell. Is this all intended to be one exhibit?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the exhibits are marked numerically for NSP, so why don't we mark yours as Exhibit A?
That would work. Or we could just go sequentially after the NSP ones as well. But
I really kind of like a distinction, so sure. Let's say Exhibit A for the advocacy staff. All right. Do you have anything, Mr.
No, Your Honor. No exhibits.
All right. Okay, then. I think we're ready to proceed, then, if there's nothing else, counsel. Ms. Valley or Mr. Simpson, who's going to be going first?
Thank you, Judge Fetch. I'll be presenting the company's witnesses today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Valley. You may proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Hall, Commissioners, and Judge Fetch. Our first witness today is Regional Vice President Laura McCartan.
All right. I know you've all heard this before, but we need to do this with every record. All witness testimony at this hearing is taken under oath and is subject to penalties for perjury. And by law, I am required to inform witnesses as to those penalties. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, which is punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000, maximum 5 years in prison, or both. Ms. McCartan, please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under pains and penalties of perjury?
I do.
Thank you. Ms. Valley.
Thank you. Since we have stipulated the evidence into the record, we'll present Ms. McCartan for cross-examination.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Then at this time, Mr. Armstrong, you may cross.
Your Honor, I think it would be Mr. Norell that would go before me as advocacy staff. Would that be acceptable?
That's acceptable.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Judge, good morning, Ms. McCartan. How are
good
you?
Good morning. I'm very well. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I was just wondering if you could give us a brief description of these projects and their locations, just so we can all be on the same page here as we start.
Sure. One project is located, called the Courtenay Project of 200 megawatts, is located in North Dakota. It's a proposed power purchase agreement. Another power purchase agreement project is for Odell, another 200 megawatt project in Minnesota. A third proposed project is Pleasant Valley, which would be a purchased and owned facility. That's a 200 megawatt project in Minnesota. And the fourth project is called Border Winds. It would be also a purchased and owned project. It's located in North Dakota. I believe it's 150 megawatts.
Thank you. The company had requested a decision on prudence by November 1st. Today's the 31st. I don't know that that's going to happen by tomorrow. How will that affect the company's decision and the progress here and the actions going forward?
Okay, we do have in each of the contracts a condition that says we need to get the approval of the commission before proceeding, so we have that as a contractual feature. We also have the ability to waive that that requirement going forward, but ideally we go forward with all of our regulatory approvals before the projects actually begin and take the initial steps they need to take in order to qualify for the production tax credit. I think there's some flexibility in there. I know earlier that was something that had to happen by the end of the year. They had to take certain actions, each of those projects, but I think they have some additional flexibility. So we would like to have the decision as soon as possible, and we'd like to see, you know, how that unfolds and what issues there may be before deciding what action we might take.
These projects have been approved by the Minnesota Commission, is that correct?
That's correct.
All four projects have been?
Yes.
Okay. Besides the North Dakota Commission, is there any other approval required by any other commissions that in jurisdictions you serve, South Dakota, Wisconsin?
I don't believe so. Okay. I'd have to subject to confirmation from my counsel. I'm not aware that we have any other conditions of approval by regulatory authorities.
Okay. Will the company be seeking cost recovery in South Dakota and Wisconsin for these projects?
Yes.
Do you know if there are any outstanding issues regarding any of these projects? I think Commissioner Kalk kind of alluded to Courtney. Could you give us a status as to where that is, the approval of that project?
Are you asking me about approval with respect to, say, siting or things?
Correct, yes, I'm sorry. Siting.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with those details. I can't answer that question.
Have the other projects received a site permit from any appropriate commissions? For example, the Minnesota ones, are there siting permits for those?
I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
In the application, it stated that RES Americas will be developing Pleasant Valley and Border Winds. Is that correct?
Yes.
In the application, it also states that the developer is very experienced with an excellent track record of siting these kind of projects. Could you just, for background, do you know how many projects they've done like this in the past?
I don't have that information handy. I don't know if our other witness does, but okay. It's certainly something we could try to get, but I don't have that.
Okay. Do you happen, or would this be a more appropriate question for Mr. Hager, would you have any other comments or insight to support that experience and the track record of RES Americas?
I don't know if Mr. Hager does, so I can't answer.
Okay. Border Winds and Pleasant Valley both consist of purchasing of an LLC. Is this different from your previous projects with Grand Meadows and Nobles Winds? Is this similar or different to those projects?
I'm sorry, I don't know the specifics of how those projects transferred in terms of the ownership structure.
Okay. Do you know what the benefits would be to purchasing an LLC as opposed to building this yourself or going forward as a power purchase agreement on these projects?
I don't know specifically about an LLC, but I can say that I think a benefit of purchasing this from RES is because they are an experienced wind project developer. So that is their skill set, that's their capability, that's their business, and it seemed to be the smart thing to do rather than trying to get into that business ourselves, is buy it from somebody who knows how to do it and has done it several times. I think your question about a power purchase agreement versus owning it, I think in our testimony we identified that we think there's benefit to having that diversity of both power purchase, which gives you the fixed price over the contract of the power purchase agreement, and the ownership, which provides the benefit of potential longer-term benefit once you've paid for the project. Every unit of energy that you generate above and beyond is additional benefit for the customers. So we think there's a benefit of having a mix of both of those.
Can you think of any, are there any disadvantages to going at it this route, the purchase of another company?
When you say the purchase of another company, again, I can't speak to the questions having to do with an LLC or those business arrangements. I think in terms of the owning, if your question is, are there disadvantages to owning a wind farm?
Yes.
Well, and I think we've talked about this in our testimony, that as the owner, we take on the O&M cost. We take on the cost of capital investments if those are needed over the lifetime of the project. And I think, as we also discussed, we believe we've conservatively modeled what those costs would be in our analysis and still show that there's a significant benefit to our customers from those owned projects as well.
In one of the data requests that staff had sent earlier, they had asked about the interconnection agreements for Courtney O'Dell, Pleasant Valley. It stated that the Odell project would have an executed generation interconnection agreement by the end of 2013. Do you happen to know the status of that at this point? Has that been signed yet?
I don't know the status of that.
Do you? Okay. Would you happen to know about any of the other projects as far as interconnection?
I'm not familiar with the details of the status of the interconnection request and analysis, no.
Are you familiar with the Minnesota Commission where these projects were or when these projects were approved?
It was quite recent. I think less than a month ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Okay. It's my understanding that there was a discussion with the transmission costs at Border Winds in particular, that if it was higher than a certain amount, then the contract would be withdrawn. Is that correct?
I am aware that we do have a provision with the Border Winds project such that if the transmission analysis indicates the costs are higher than we anticipate, we have the ability to walk away so that we wouldn't be required to go forward with the project if it cost more and didn't have the full benefit for our customers. So I'm aware that we do have that sort of arrangement.
Okay. Is it possible, though, I also think there was discussion that the transmission costs could be higher but still be economical. Is that correct because of the pricing long term?
It's my understanding that there is some headroom there. I don't know the exact cutoff, but I understand that there is some headroom. By which I mean, I'm sorry, I'm using a form. To be more clear in my response to you, my understanding is that there is some additional cost of transmission interconnection under which the Border Winds project would still be of benefit to our customers. I don't know the exact number.
Okay. Do you know who would know that number or where we could get that number?
Well, I believe Mr. Hager could respond more thoroughly to your question, and then I don't know how much of it is trade secret, and then we'd have to treat it that way.
Sure. Do you have an engineering background? Is that correct?
I have a nuclear engineering background.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering, do you happen to, as an engineer, are there any issues that you would see with interconnection of adding this much power to MISO's system in such a short time frame? Are there engineering concerns there?
You know, I'm not an electrical engineer or a power engineer, and that's where that expertise would come into play. But I think that we are relying on people who have that expertise, deep expertise. And my understanding from our evaluation of these projects is that we're confident that they can be integrated into the system, and we try to model conservatively what any associated cost with doing that. But we wouldn't have brought this forward if we had any concern or question about the ability to integrate these projects into, you know, MISO, which is a very large footprint and very large market to integrate wind into.
Sure. Within that large footprint, there's also some other projects. For example, there's the Border Winds at the PSC just granted siting, I believe, too. There's Thunder Spirit down southwestern North Dakota. What would you say, again, this is kind of the coffee shop banter, I guess, maybe. What if there's a massive geographic, we've got all this wind's going and ramping up at it's all going max capacity, and all of a sudden, in a matter of an hour or two, the wind just dies geographically. How would the company respond to that from a system, or looking at how would the system accommodate something like that, such mm-hmm. a loss of a large amount of wind energy?
Mm-hmm. I think that is certainly part of the planning that happens when MISO looks at how do you maintain reliability. I mean, that reliable service is probably the number one thing that MISO is responsible for. And there are federal regulations and federal entities that also regulate reliability, National Energy Regulatory Reliability Council. So I think that the planning and the interconnections and the requirements that are put on power plants take that into account as the number one thing. I can't answer exactly how that happens, but I think our witness, Kurt Hager, could. But I don't think we're anywhere with the footprint of MISO. My understanding is we're confident that we can integrate this wind, in fact, even more wind than this, that others would anticipate adding into the footprint.
numerous places in the application and testimony, it's mentioned that one of the benefits of this project is the amount of conventional fuel it displaces. Again, kind of back to the guy, to borrow a phrase from Commissioner Kalk, the guy up at Valley Dairy in Grand Forks is sitting there going, we've got 800 years worth of lignite coal in North Dakota. Why isn't NSP looking at tapping into that as opposed to this wind? How would you answer that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing I would say is that the primary thing that that customer gets from this is they're going to get lower energy prices. Their bill's going to be lower because this wind is lower cost than a lot of its natural gas, some of its coal, that would otherwise be used to serve that increment of energy. So that's what our analysis shows. That's what we think is the clear benefit to customers is you'll pay less. Maybe an analogy for the kind of the coffee shop where people are like, well, I want my lights to come on and I'm worried about my bill is, and the way I think of these wind projects is we're running our natural gas plant. I mean, this isn't a perfect analogy, but I think it sort of works. You run your natural gas plants, and when the wind's on, you're taking the wind. It's almost like you have a fixed price fuel contract for that energy that's lower than this other fuel that you'd be getting to run that natural gas plant. So it's an imperfect analogy, but in many ways, I think it's actually speaking to what happens. It lowers our customers' prices because it's a lower fuel cost. We have a diverse mix, so we continue to use coal. We continue to use natural gas. We've got our nuclear. This is one piece of it that we think provides benefit to our customers.
Kind of another question that had been alluded to earlier would be, how does ADP benefit the customer? I could see, and probably the guy at the coffee shop could see how it benefits the shareholder. How does ADP benefit the customer?
Well, I think the benefit to the customer is that it allows us to come to our commission and have this public discussion about significant choices that have to be made today for the long term. And these choices, I think in this case, it is pretty clear cut. I think it's pretty clear cut that there's a clear benefit and cost reduction to customers. Other things that an ADP looks at are much more complicated, and you have to weigh what do you think the future is going to hold? What do you think risk mitigation is? What level is proper? So I think having that conversation, which an ADP allows us to do with the commissioner, helps us understand, is this the right decision to go forward with our customer? In the alternative, you make that investment, you go forward with that project, and then you come forth at the time that you're in a rate case, and that could be 4 years down the road from the time you actually had to start it or more. I think the benefit is it allows us to have that public policy, that customer impact discussion early, and there's still the subsequent, you know, rate case and rate recovery decision down the road.
All right. Well, I have no further questions.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Cardwell, do you have any questions?
No, Judge.
Mr. Diller? All right, we'll proceed at this time then to Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Ms. McCartan, you're the regional vice president of NSP, correct?
That's correct.
What's your region?
Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota.
And I'd like to first talk to you about the case number 706, 707, and 708, which are not the Board of Winds one, the Odell, Pleasant Valley, and Courtney, okay?
Okay.
Because that's the way I read the applications and the testimony is that a conservative estimate, this will save customers, I think, $180 million over 20 to 25 years. Is that correct?
Right. I don't know if it's 180 or 176, but yes, generally that number.
Correct. You're right. I guess that did change.
Yeah.
Why do you say conservative?
The reason that I say conservative is because we believe we've made conservative assumptions in how we've modeled these projects. Conservative in the sense that it's probably more likely that they will generate more energy for the cost that we're looking at. It's probably more likely that some of the costs that we modeled in the project aren't actually going to be at that level, so the actual cost of the project would be less. So those are two examples of, I think, the conservatism, and Mr. Hager could go into much more detail there. But I think we analyzed a conservatism that we would probably reflect this at a higher cost with less energy. So we tried to make conservative estimates of that case. And if they truly are conservative, then we get lower cost, more energy. It's even a better deal for our customers.
And I realize part of what we're dealing with here is somewhat trying to predict what's likely to happen in the future. Is that correct?
Yes.
What are some of the circumstances or things that could happen that would make this not save customers money?
You know, I think I'm going to ask you to direct that question to Mr. Hager, because we did many sensitivity analyses. We looked at what if gas prices were going to be lower than what we projected. We also looked at what if gas prices would be higher. We looked at what if our O&M cost associated with our own projects would be higher or lower. So depending upon which set of circumstances you look at, there might be some that wouldn't save money, but I think the bulk of all of the sensitivities that we looked at save our customers money, just maybe not as much. So we, in some cases more, in some cases less, but still saving customers money.
And maybe this is for Mr. Hager, and I'm going to ask you, and if you could answer as much as you can, and then I'll ask him the more specifics. But my general understanding is that it was modeled on, I think, a 3.4% increase in the price of gas, and then also evaluated if it was 1.7. But I'm curious of what information supports the increase in the price of natural gas, those amounts.
My understanding is we use third-party industry sources for projecting what the price of gas will do over time, and Mr. Hager could. So that's kind of what the industry believes. Mr. Hager could answer in more detail.
And then this is, in your testimony, you discuss that the now I just forgot the words, the combustion turbines. Those are somewhat related to the 706, 707, and 708 cases. Is that correct?
The 706, 708, those are the three wind projects we're talking about. And you're asking me, are the combustion turbines related to them?
Well, what you said in your testimony was that these projects won't provide timely capacity to eliminate the proposed combustion turbines, and I'd like some clarification on that.
Okay, so I would say that they're not related. I would say that the value and the reason we're bringing forth these wind projects is because they save customers money, period. The other projects, the combustion turbines, they're proposed to meet a need out in the 17-18 timeframe when we think we might need some extra capacity to serve our system overall. The wind projects would not serve that capacity need. They don't supplant that need.
So if these projects go through and are producing the energy NSP expects, you would still expect, as you sit here anyway, that these combustion turbines would still come online and provide additional capacity that is beneficial to the customers?
The wind projects, when they come online, their primary benefit and the reason that we're bringing the force is because they provide energy. So they provide energy. We don't have to rely on them for capacity. They provide energy at a lower cost than we otherwise would be able to get it. So it flows directly through the customers to save money. The power plants that we're looking at, the combustion turbines out in the 2018 timeframe, the need for those is so that you have a power plant you can turn on when you need it, a dispatchable resource, so that if you've got a peaking need for your system or something like that, you have a power plant you can turn on. So they really serve two different needs.
But presumably, if the wind is creating energy, you won't have to, consistent energy, you won't have to turn on the combustion turbines as much. Is that correct?
You know, I think maybe Mr. Hager can have this conversation better with you, but again, the difference is that you have that combustion turbine so you can turn it on when you need it. And typically, a combustion turbine of that sort, or the need that we've identified out in that period of time, is not where you run that power plant a lot because you need the energy. You have it there so you can turn it on when you need the capacity. It's like peak times. The wind will blow and deliver the energy when it will, and it will supplant higher priced energy costs. The combustion turbine is there to provide capacity and meet system load needs at times of peak. I'm probably getting beyond my expertise and would say Kurt Hager could really have a very good discussion and answer your questions, I think, more thoroughly.
Mr. Norell had asked you some questions about coal and natural gas, but I guess I kind of see an interrelation here between you've got wind farms producing energy, you've got the combustion turbines to address peak periods, and then you've got these other power sources. What is the effect of these projects on other power sources, such as coal or other natural gas sources?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I believe that in our modeling, we believe that because of the price of these wind projects, they would supplant or replace higher-priced coal or natural gas-fueled power when the wind plants are operating. So in that extent, it would generally, if you look at it in isolation, back off the production from those coal or natural gas-fueled power plants in the region.
And if the wind's not blowing and these projects are not producing energy, then would that be replaced by coal, or would that be replaced by these combustion turbines, or how would that work?
Well, that would come out of the MISO market, and I think Kurt Hager could be a better person to walk you through exactly how energy needs are met kind of hour by hour in the MISO market and relying on the fleet of power plants that are available in the region.
Is there a price change, like say you're supplying energy through these wind farms and it's getting used and then the wind's not blowing and you need to get energy from another source? Does that make NSP have to pay more for that energy?
I would ask you to direct that energy to that question to Kurt Hager. I think, you know, it's our efforts to plan and meet our customers' needs are really take into account all of those. It's really a kind of very complicated. There's long-term looks ahead. There's hour-by-hour decisions that are made. So we have a plan that looks at all of those things. We have a plan that says how much energy we are going to get out of wind based upon we've got forecasting abilities that we have honed over the last couple of years that are really sort of, I think, recognized in the country as being among the best, if not the best, for wind forecasting. We put that together with all the other information we have about our power plants, what's available in the market, and we are constantly making choices to get the lowest cost energy for our customers.
And I'm going to move on to border winds next, but I just want to ask you a very general question that goes to the heart of our issues here, I think, on these the 706, 707, and 708. If you could just tell us in, you know, as good a plain English as you can, why NSP thinks these projects are prudent.
We think these projects are prudent because our very conservative analysis shows that they will save our customers money, significant money, over the lifetime of the project. So that's really, in essence, why we think they're prudent. They work well for our customers.
Moving on to
yes.
I guess we'll start off with the prudence, same as the last question. Why does NSP think the border winds project is prudent?
Again, because we believe it will save our customers significant money over the lifetime of the project.
And that's, am I correct, that was estimated $25 million over 20 to 25 years, give or take?
Yes.
And I understand from border winds, and Mr. Newell asked you about this, is part of whether that's apparently going to be prudent is what the interconnection costs are going to be.
Yes, my understanding is there still is that is a question that needs to be resolved here.
And that's something that will happen in the future.
Correct.
Do you have any idea when that interconnection cost will be known?
Sometime in 2014. I'm not exactly sure when. It's it will result from some study work that MISO's involved in that's planned for 2014. I can't remember what time frame we had provided.
And at least as I understood your testimony in the application, it's NSP's sole discretion whether that cost is too high or too low to finalize the agreement.
If we believe it's too high, we have the ability to walk away from it, from that project. That's right.
Just trying to put it out there, I guess, bluntly, the way, kind of the question I have with that, we're being asked to declare that prudent, and there's this, could be significant cost that could make NSP determine it's not prudent. How would you propose the commission deal with addressing that, knowing that there's this unknown out there that may or may not make the project prudent?
Exactly. I think there are provisions that where the if there's an ADP granted, there could be a conditional provision in there that gets right to that question and protects customers from that. You know, provides the customer protection that the commission would be interested in.
And the simple mind in me says, you've said there's going to be a $45 million benefit over 20 to 25 years, and I guess, you know, if it's $45 million to interconnect, that kind of takes out the cost savings. Is where am I wrong in thinking that simply?
I think you're right. I mean, I think that is in essence, the sort of the magnitude of what the change would have to be. And I believe that the analysis and what we understand today is we believe that the interconnection costs for that project are likely to be not of that nature. So we're not walking into it with no sort of expectation or understanding of what it might be, but the analysis isn't complete. So there is that check-in that would have to happen.
Globally speaking, with all of these projects, is NSP seeking prudence and ADP a prudence for all four of them collectively or individually, meaning if the commission determines one of them that isn't prudent or we don't have enough information to be prudent, does NSP still want prudence for the other three? Or, you know, if it's two, is still want prudence for the other two? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
I think I do. We're asking for an ADP for all four. We believe that the analysis is comparable for all four in terms of with the exception of the border winds and with the exception then of having a provision that would say subject to confirmation of that that transmission interconnection cost.
Am I correct, though? I mean, just throwing projects out there with no real, you know, meaning anything by them. But say the commission were to say the Courtney Wind Farm project is not prudent, NSP would still want prudence on the other three, the Odell, Pleasant Valley, and border winds.
Yes.
Let me clarify, Mr. Armstrong, is the basis for your question an all-or-nothing answer? Okay, do you understand, Ms. McCartan? What he's asking is it the company's position that we want all prudence for all four or nothing?
It's not the latter. I tried to make the distinction that we think that the data that we presented for all four is comparable and shows each and every one of them provides significant benefit to our customers.
And I guess my understanding from the applications is you filed separate applications for all of them. We are having a combined hearing because there's related issues with them. But my understanding anyway is NSP's position is each of them stands on their own, but you want approval for all of them.
Yes.
Thank you. That's much clearer.
For the public certificate of public convenience and necessity on the Border Winds project, just summarize for us why you think that should be granted.
For the Border Winds?
Yes.
Because we believe our conservative analysis shows that the Border Winds project provides benefit to our customers by lowering their energy cost over the lifetime of that project.
Is there a need for this additional energy, or is there a desire for this additional energy source, if you know what I mean? If this project isn't built, will the customer base still receive energy?
They will still receive energy at a higher price. So this gets back to my point that I think an analogy that is useful is that this is basically buying a fixed price, lower fuel contract. Because in essence, it operates as a fuel. I mean, it's not perfect, but when the wind's blowing, if you back off another power plant, it's as though it's just a new fuel source providing that same amount of energy.
Nothing further.
Thank you. Mr. Lean, did you have any questions? All right, thank you. Then at this time, I'll move to the commission. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Laura, for your testimony. And I also want to thank you, too, I always appreciate when the head of the company comes out and starts off the testimony. We've had different cases where it's not been that way, so it shows your concern, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And I'll say, too, that I appreciate the work that Xcel has done over my time here with helping out with the meter challenges we've had in Thompson and a lot of the reliability things that we've worked through in the whatever rate case it was a while back, and then getting through all the CapEx decisions on that transmission line. I thought that went very well. And so I just want to thank you for that and Xcel's work. Now I continue with my next line of questions, all right? So you set it up. I'm just trying to get a better feel for Xcel's philosophy when it comes to ADP. The commission before I got here, and I'm not sure if I agree with that decision, directed Xcel Energy to come in front of the commission and request ADP on projects. Is that the way you understand it as well?
Yes, that was a part of a settlement or a condition from a previous rate case.
So then we've both been involved in a previous case where the Xcel came in and asked for ADP and the commission, different mix at that time. I was part of that mix, sent it back to you because it was untimely because you'd already entered into the decision to do it before you came in for ADP. I mean, do you remember that case as well?
Commissioner, which case was that?
That was the recent ADP. I'll have to pull the number out here. Maybe Mitch can help me out here. But when we had the which is the wind farm in the rate case right now.
Oh, thank you. The Prairie Rose Wind Project?
There we go.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
So, but you're familiar with that's when the company came in after you'd made the decision and then asked for ADP?
Yes.
Okay, so that's an issue we'll have to deal with in the rate case. So in this case, we have a suite of projects that you're asking for ADP, and you've entered into no contracts in any of these at this time. Is that correct?
We have contracts, and each of those contracts has a has a requirement that we receive commission approval where required. So that's here in North Dakota as well as in Minnesota.
So you've signed contracts with these companies to buy to purchase all these things, if you will, but you have a escape clause that if the North Dakota Commission doesn't approve something, then you can get out of those contracts?
I think that's, yeah. I mean, that's one way to put it, right? That we went ahead with the contracts because the timing was such that if we didn't move with these, we would lose the opportunity to capture the production tax credit, which can be a third to a quarter of the price of the project. And that's what brings these prices down so low that they provide that benefit to customers. But then we put in the condition in those contracts, the regulatory approval.
Okay, then. The Minnesota Commission, when you say the Minnesota Commission has approved the projects, do you mean they've approved an ADP or they've approved them in a rate case? Or I guess it wouldn't be a rate case. What do you mean by approve it, that Minnesota's approved it?
Yes. The Minnesota, I believe it's the Certificate of Need approval. No, it was for approval of the, I don't know the exact approval, but it's, I think part of it was the power purchase agreement, and then the owned projects will have to come forward in a rate case in the future.
Okay. If it weren't for the previous commission order directing you to come in for ADP, would you be here today? I mean, you don't need our approval. You can make these company decisions.
Well, Commissioner, I think part of the reason that provision ended up in the previous rate case was actually a dialogue between us and the commission about how to work better with the commission, how to provide them information early on so that we could have this exchange and talk about what we were doing, the choices we had before us, how we were trying to make those decisions, get that feedback from the commission before we proceeded and made those commitments. As the alternative would be to just show up in a rate case and say, here we are. And I think at the time it was felt that with everything that was going on with the complexity of the energy industry and the choices that we were having to make with a lot of the uncertainty facing us as an industry, it was more productive, it was ultimately better for our customers if we had that dialogue and the ADP was the venue or the vehicle to have that dialogue.
So you're saying the company understood that was the commission's intent, but still came in and asked for ADP after you'd already made the contract in place on the previous wind farm we talked about.
We acknowledge we could have been more timely with that. It was not, I think there were a lot of factors in play there, but we've tried to, you know, step up and come in with ADP.
What I'm
ADPs.
Trying to get to is that let's say we grant ADP and everything. That's easy to see through. Then at some point in time it comes back for a rate case. But if I would vote to not grant ADP, that doesn't mean the company can't still enter into all these agreements. We would just sort it out in a rate case. Is that correct?
My understanding, and I've heard that from the commission before, that a denial of an ADP doesn't automatically lead to or set up that they would not approve in a rate case. I think it does create a it sets the bar up, certainly. I mean,
I can tell you from my viewpoint is that I would look at it, a case in the rate case is how things played out. You make projections and things change. I understand that. But if I would not approve this ADP, that doesn't mean that that same decision would follow through in a rate case. I don't believe those two correlate. Now, I do believe if I grant ADP, I have to give you something in the rate case. But just because you would not approve ADP, I don't see it that way in the law. You see it differently?
Well, that's an interesting question. The ADP, we present all the information at this point that's available to us about how we're making this choice. And then ultimately, some of that shows up in a rate case. If you were to review all of that information in the ADP and say no, then there would be something about, I mean, it would depend upon what the reason would be. It would really, because if part of the reason was we don't think that's prudent, and then we continue and show up in a rate case, then the question would be, why are you here? If you approve it based upon the information's there, and we show up in the rate case, unless there's something that really significantly changed, we think the record holds and the decision making and all the analysis says if that's still true, then there should be, you know, we would think, okay, we would get cost recovery unless we did something in executing those projects that wasn't prudent.
The cost of this project will be spread across several states, correct?
Correct.
And South Dakota is one of those states?
Correct.
But you're not going down to South Dakota and asking for ADP?
South Dakota does not have that requirement.
Do they have the ADP law?
You know, I should know that. We have not been bringing ADPs to them, so I don't think they do.
I'll have to ask our counsel to double check that. But my understanding was, I don't even want to say, I guess. I'll check on that. But it still goes back to, I don't believe that if there was, if the requirement of the commission was not that you have to come in ADP, I mean, you maybe not wouldn't be here. You just make your decisions. That's my whole frustration with the ADP law is that I'm not the board of directors of Xcel Energy.
Well, you're right. And before the ADPs, we didn't come in when we did bring it all in a rate case. And I think as we found as we went through several, you know, discrete decisions that had to be made in resource planning and others, and it was felt, I think, at the time, and I believe that having the opportunity to look at these one by one with some structure and rigor through an ADP is helpful rather than kind of bringing all of that in to a rate case where you still have to go through that same analysis and review.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I think we both got our points out there.
Okay.
The couple other questions, I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit. How do you get energy to your Minot market, if you will?
My understanding is we have contracts with providers in this area, and we have exchanges companies that serve this area more closely, that we have contracts where we can get local power supply.
So Xcel has no baseload generation in North Dakota right now?
That's correct.
Why don't you look at baseload generation in North Dakota when you have to buy power from Minot, and this would really beef up your liability for Grand Forks and for Fargo area? I mean, from your viewpoint, leadership position, why hasn't the company looked at a baseload type of plant in the western edge of your system?
Well, Commissioner, we do resource plan and we look at our whole system as a whole. We haven't identified a need for baseload power for some time. I can't. The last bit of baseload that we're adding is as a result of the power upgrade at Monticello. Yeah, exactly, which you're familiar with. We haven't had a need for baseload power plants. So if we don't have the need, then we shouldn't build it. And I would say that our provisions that we have in place to serve the Minot area, we're very comfortable with, that they're very solid, that they're going to provide reliable service to our customers, and they have for a long time. Sort of a paper transaction of keeping track of where the energy flows, but it does rely upon the baseload and other power sources that are located in the state.
Okay. North Dakota is 4% of Xcel's footprint, is that correct?
I think that the overall, the energy use out of our North Dakota customers presents about 4% of the total of the NSP system.
Okay. The now, Minnesota has certain mandates for renewable, is that correct?
That's correct.
What are Minnesota's mandates for renewable?
Minnesota's mandates for Xcel Energy, 30% of our energy needs by the year 2020 must come from renewable energy sources. In addition, I mean, there's a lot of qualifiers. 25% of our energy needs has to come from wind resources, particularly. So of that 30%, the bulk of it has to come from wind. And just last session, the commission, the legislature also passed a law requiring us to get 1.5% of our customers' energy needs from solar power by the year 2020.
So is that a requirement for all of Minnesota or just the investor owns?
The 1.5%, I believe, is just the investor owns, and then there's also some provisions that exclude certain types of customers.
Okay. The if all these projects get built and or you are able to purchase the power, where does that leave Xcel Energy getting towards your 30% renewable mandate for Minnesota?
So, Commissioner, if your question is, if we bring on these four projects and they're operating, how close are we to meeting our mandate?
Yes.
Let's see. If these projects come on in 2016, we add up both power production and renewable energy credits that are banked from previous year's power production above and beyond what's needed to meet the goal, we will be ahead of the 30%. I mean, we're ahead of the trajectory that gets you to 30% by 2020. I don't know exactly where in that point we would be.
How do you rate the requirement from Minnesota to meet that mandate with the requirement that I would ask for of making sure you need it and it's cost effective?
Absolutely, and I would agree with you on that. And I
but
think,
how do you do it?
How do we do it?
How do you measure those two?
Well, I think that we do it by going out into the market to secure renewable resources and finding the best price we can. And each time we've been out in the market, particularly for wind, we've always found that the wind projects that are offered at that time are very comparable and compatible with what the other energy source that we would have chosen, which would typically be a natural gas-fueled power plant. So I think that as we've built our portfolio over time, we've done it in a way very deliberately where we don't go out and buy it all at once. We've spread it out over time so that we can take advantage of prices as they change. And just in these particular projects, the primary we didn't need them now to serve the renewable energy standard because we were on track and doing well. We went out and actually issued an RFP because we thought because of the market conditions with the looming potential loss of the production or renewal of the production tax credit, that there might be good prices. And we found there were such good prices that we could secure these wind projects that would bring our customers' energy prices down right now, and, oh, by the way, become part of our renewable energy portfolio at a very, very low cost. So everything we did with these projects was primarily to see if we could get low prices, but by bringing them on, we also are ensuring that our wind portfolio, our renewable portfolio, is very low cost to serve our customers.
Okay. Is there a penalty for Minnesota if you don't meet that 30% by 2020?
I'm not aware of exact penalty, and I know that the law also has in it provisions that allow outs that are based on cost and also based on is their transmission capability. So I don't know that there's a dollar provision specifically defined in the law. We could look into that and come back, I think.
All right, just a few more. So this is 750 megawatts of wind we're talking about. I guess I'll save these for the resource planning. We talked through Minnesota approval, CapEx. Okay, this next question, I can't remember if it was Mr. Norell or Mr. Armstrong asked you the question about the wind farms, the Courtenay wind farm, and you said you didn't have the information on siting. So you don't have an understanding of how that project is progressing at all?
Commissioner, I don't. People in my company do. And the provision is that the developer has to bring that project to us, and then they need to get that project all in place. We buy the power output.
Okay, so when you look at buying the power from a purchase power agreement, you just look at the end cost is how you make your decision? How do you look at the viability of a wind farm, the risk associated with that wind farm, or do you just look at the end cost they're offering to sell you the power at?
Commissioner, I think our analysis is really quite sophisticated and it looks at all aspects of that. when we did the request for proposals earlier in February of this year, we asked for any type of project, power purchase agreement, owned, variations of those themes. And our analysis looked at the unique characteristics of power purchase agreements versus owned versus something else, so that we were really understanding all aspects there. Kurt Hager could answer more specific details about exactly what we looked at with projects that are proposed as power purchase agreements.
Okay, because not so much, I don't think, for power purchase agreements, but if some of these, we've had discussion in the commission about habitat conservation plans, that the risk associated if a wind farm does not have those, and where that risk would be transferred to. I would think that a power purchase agreement, that risk would never be transferred to the company, but I don't know that that's 100% clear. Another type of arrangements. Do you know anything about that risk transfer?
I think Mr. Hager, I'm throwing a bunch of stuff over to you, Kurt, but I think Mr. Hager could speak to you about how we factor that in our analysis and assessments of these projects.
Okay. Has Xcel Energy ever taken a position in favor of carbon tax?
I believe that, now going over the years, I can't tell you exactly what position. I know that there was a point when, I mean, we have worked at the federal level with the policymakers to try to shape that discussion in the best interest of our customers. I can't tell you exactly between carbon tax, cap and trade, what we've promoted or supported in what nature of a negotiation. I'm sorry, I just don't have that. I'd be guessing if I tried to answer that.
I've read testimony from Mr. Falke in front of the Congress that he basically is for some type of carbon tax, and he supported the cap and trade system.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's important to get that added into this record or the next one, but the carbon tax, you've got the company CEO lobbying for a carbon tax, and then you've got cost of CO2 in some of your planning. So if those costs were all stripped out of this, does that change your analysis at all?
Commissioner, our analysis showing the cost benefit to customers that we presented shows without the valuation of the carbon and the other things as required by this commission, and we still show that it's of benefit to our customers.
Fair enough. But is Xcel's position that you support carbon taxes going forward?
Well, Commissioner, I'd say what we would support is a clear policy from the federal government so we know how to plan. One of the things that's a big uncertainty that we're grappling with is, will there be a carbon tax? And if so, how do we make the choices today that are going to play out over 20 or 30, 40 years for our customers that are going to be good for our customers? With that uncertainty and lack of clarity, that comes back and puts risk on choices that we make today. And frankly, a carbon tax would be one way to get clarity. Is it the best way? I don't know. But one of the things about these wind projects is they also provide a hedge in the future for our customers. If there are increasing environmental regulations, as well as volatility in fuel costs from other power sources, having these wind projects provide further benefit to our customers.
Okay, thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Before we move ahead, we're going to take a 15-minute break.
Good idea, Jim.
I've looked around. I've seen the expressions. Well, thank you.